Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now.
Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv, here with another very special and very exciting of my Conversations episodes. So today I sat down with Dr. Jeremy Swist. We didn't actually sit down. I don't know why I phrase it like that. I mean, it's a pandemic. We talked over video. But all the same, I talked to Dr. Jeremy Swist all about the fascinating world of classical reception in metal music, which I did not really know was a thing until I started following him on Twitter, and then sort of we become Twitter friends, and I've learned so much about that, learned obviously even more in this conversation, but it's really quite fascinating the volume of classical reception in metal music and the nuances, the intricacies of it, and honestly, just really fascinating episode. You should definitely listen to it, even if you're not into metal music. I think it's just a really fascinating take on classics and mythology. We talked about the reception of mythology, but also history, and the way it is used and also misused in this world, very similarly to how it is in the wider world of not just metal music, but just sort of taking in the classics in general. It's a fine line sometimes, and it's quite interesting to see how that intersects in metal music. We talk a lot about specific songs and albums in this conversation, and so Jeremy was nice enough to actually put together a Spotify playlist so that if you are interested in listening to the songs that we talk about or more songs related to classical reception, you can check it out on the Spotify playlist. It is in the description of your episode, so if you're listening on a podcatcher right now, just click on those details and you can pop it right up for when you're done listening to the episode. We are making it convenient for you. And with all of that out of the way, please enjoy this episode. It was so much fun to record. I mean, I say this every time, but I honestly am just so thrilled with the way my own knowledge gets to broaden with all of these conversations, things I never thought I would be talking about with anyone and learning so much. And then in turn, I get to share it all with you, and all you nerds get to get even nerdier and learn so much with me. It is just such a very fun thrill. So I hope you like it. Enjoy. Conversations. Let's talk about metal, baby! Classical reception in metal music with Dr. Jeremy Swist. I am here today with Dr. Jeremy Swist. I'm here to talk about mythology in metal music. So thank you so much for chatting with me today and dealing with the repetitive nature of my introductions.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, happy to. We've been talking on Twitter quite a lot, especially about things like this, but or mythology in general, or the darkness that is the world of mythology on Twitter sometimes and various things. So it seems only right to actually like have you on the podcast to talk about it. So what you study classical reception in metal music specifically, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. Mythology and history and, you know, related topics, and also some Byzantine Empire stuff as well.
That makes sense. That would be involved in it a lot as well. It's very like kind of, it's interesting to say it has that kind of like, I hate the word vibe, and yet somehow it's sometimes only the right word, because it's obviously metal music wouldn't have really had a vibe in the classical world, but it does seem to just suit the connection so well. But I think this specifically came up because of Medusa, because I think Medusa, she appears in a lot of metal songs. Is she kind of a bigger one, or one you study more rather?
Absolutely. So, you know, this is something that you can even quantify. You go onto the website for the what's called the Encyclopedia Metallum, which is, you know, a website where it's essentially an open source database of every metal band that has been around since the 70s that has recorded material, and you can find lyrics and artwork and all of that. And it has an advanced search where you can type in the keyword Medusa and to see where it shows up in lyrics. And there are literally hundreds of songs and bands that either have songs on Medusa or are called Medusa or have concept albums on Medusa. She's very popular and has been since the 80s, when bands like Angel Witch and Anthrax had songs on Medusa. So, for instance, one of the very first instances of classical reception in heavy metal is in 1980, where the band Angel Witch, they're a British new wave British heavy metal band, have a song called The Gorgon. And I like to mention that because it's not technically a song about Medusa, because it's actually a song based on a 1960s horror movie called The Gorgon, which has, I think, Peter Cushing and Vincent Price in it.
Oh my God. Can't believe I didn't know that existed.
And yeah, I think you'd like it. It's basically, it's about, in somehow, Stheno and Euryale, one of them, the sisters of Medusa, managed to, in the 20th century, take possession of some woman, and such that she is able to, you know, turn men into stone. And so I think the plot has something to do with this woman's lover ends up having to, well, sorry about spoilers.
for a movie from the 1960s, you're okay.
Ends up having to kill her in the end. So it sort of has that tragic sense to it.
Yeah.
And so that's what this song is about. And what this song also does, you know, drawing from the film, is it sort of sets the precedent of how Medusa is received in heavy metal music in general as an archetypal femme fatale. And this is an image, an archetype that is just all over metal, you know, since the 80s, where, you know, powerful women, you know, are kind of viewed as, you know, threats to masculine control. whether they're actually dangerous because they're witches or they have some sort of, you know, power, or simply because of their sexual power, and the kind of that the threat that that poses to masculine control, where, you know, you become enslaved to, you know, some woman who uses her sexual power to emasculate you. And so, for instance, the probably the most well-known metal song on Medusa is the song Medusa by Anthrax from 1985. And if you read that lyrics to that song, you know, it kind of, there's a lot of sexual innuendo in how it talks about Medusa, you know, how she lures you in, she sucks you in to her cave. it's not very subtle.
I'm looking up the lyrics.
Right. But you see that, you know, in general, where both in album artwork and in the lyrics, she is, you know, a typical kind of heavy metal femme fatale. She becomes kind of a sorceress that, you know, brings men under her spell, turns them to stone. And in the artwork, she's often highly sexualized. Yet at the same time, she's also depicted the way Harryhausen, you know, did in the 1981 Clash of the Titans, where she has that very serpentine form. And so it sort of brings those sort of contradictions together very much, this sort of, you know, this her as this kind of temptress, but also this very inhuman monster, you know, in order to otherize and exoticize her.
Yeah, while simultaneously keeping her sexualized. That image is so interesting because it's become like the Medusa. Mm-hmm. Like, every version of her these days, it seems, in any kind of popular culture depicts her in that kind of way, where she has this snake body. But obviously, mythologically, there's nothing to suggest she ever had a snake body. Mm-hmm. But it is such, it's a way to make her more monstrous, because she isn't really described specifically with any details of monstrosity. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, there's like the Gorgon imagery. But I always find it interesting that that's almost exclusively like labeled as a Gorgon imagery versus Medusa by name. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of Medusa theories that are not fully founded in like actual archaeology or like any kind of academic research, but just based on obsessively reading everything about her and then being attacked by men on the internet. But that's an interesting thing to like keep her sexualized while also making her exclusively monstrous.
Yeah. So for instance, if you look up in terms of album artwork, there's a band called Axe Battler. I think they're from South America. And one of their albums, which has a song about, you know, Perseus and Medusa, shows her in her very Harryhausen-esque serpentine form, but also her, you know, her upper body is highly sexualized much more than Harryhausen. And then in stark contrast, you also see Perseus depicted pretty much like Conan the Barbarian, with like, you know, highly muscly and with long hair and a loincloth and you know, very different. There, his masculine body is very, you know, is in total contrast to Medusa's very, you know, eroticized body. And so this is sort of the flip side to a lot of classical reception in terms of male figures and heroes, is they are sort of, you know, they are seen as sort of Conan the Barbarian types, you know, these sort of, if you look at the band Manowar, for instance, their artwork, as well as the way that they dressed and looked, in at least in the 80s, you know, it was very easy to see figures like Achilles and Perseus and certainly Heracles, you know, fitting this mold, because in general, metal is interested in these hyper-masculine figures who kind of represent this sort of almost this Homeric warrior ethos of, you know, individuality and glory and sort of, you know, the individual against society and against the world. You know, they're self-sufficient, you know, they are able to, you know, exert that sort of patriarchal control.
It's also a very kind of almost modern take on that heroism too, because that like super muscular is not really something that shows up in a lot of Greek imagery. Like, they're muscular, but they're not like Conan the Barbarian muscular, or like even the, you know, more recent Hercules adaptations, where the guys are just like absolutely jacked, is not really something that was actually depicted in Greek imagery And it, I think it probably would have been hard for them to get that jacked, given it's 100% based in like modern ideals and like modern methods and all those things. But it's an interesting part to kind of like make that even more like hyper masculine than they actually would have been back then.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another parallel I draw with kind of what heavy metal does and what, say, Homeric poetry does, and the, you know, the vase paintings and whatnot that sort of are based on it, is, you know, it is a modern, very much modern kind of physical ideal. But, you know, Homer talks about how, you know, this is how the heroes were back in the Age of Heroes, when, you know, men were real manly men and they could, you know, hurl stones that 10 people today couldn't lift and all of that. And that sort of gets at, you know, another major reason why heavy metal, you know, tends to be drawn to, you know, not just mythology, but also, you know, ancient history and medieval history, is there's that sense of nostalgia. You know, heavy metal is very much a transgressive genre that, you know, loves to kind of reject, you know, modern capitalist post-industrialized neoliberal society in favor of some kind of, and try to escape to some sort of fantasy of the past or mythology or fantasy literature and all of that, where they see sort of a more authentic humanity that was somehow lost or rejected by the modern day. And so it's very much, I think, the way that Homer and kind of the Greeks of the historical period would look back to the Bronze Age and think of it as this kind of past that they're trying to bring back, but is in other ways kind of irretrievable, because they're so disillusioned with, you know, the way society is now, with, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I mean, yeah, you even have, so it has specific where in the some, you know, some takes on the early myths have it as actually like the different ages of man, and therefore like completely irretrievable, these, this like old age where just they all died out and they're all gone, which is something I haven't really been able to touch upon on the podcast too much, because I just feel like it's too in the weeds. But it's an interesting thing to think about, where it is just like this completely irretrievable past, but that just gets like romanticized in this way where it's just like, oh, today we're awful, let's like look back on this world where, yeah, we're men and all of that nonsense.
Yeah, and that sort of gets into some of the politics of this kind of reception, especially with bands that, you know, are more upfront with their politics and their extreme politics. You know, heavy metal, you know, especially in its more extreme genres of, you know, black metal and death metal, is extreme music that can attract extreme views, often is sort of the cliche there. But, you know, it's not, those genres aren't inherently, you know, right wing, but, you know, a lot of left wing people, you know, play it too. But, you know, for instance, there's something I've been exploring, is how a lot of bands, you know, that are, you know, politically explicitly right wing kind of have these nostalgic narratives of bringing back this mythologized past, particularly like Alexander's or the Roman Empire. And they think that this past can be achieved by this kind of nihilistic apocalyptic war, in which basically civilization is just torn down, and then the only people that survive are, you know, the people who are, you know, the most fit to. And so for certain bands, that's it's pretty clear what kind of people they mean, and that can, and this, and by doing this, you can then return to a society in which these patriarchal masculine warrior values are acceptable again. You know, for one thing, it's like there's a couple bands in Australia, New Zealand, you know, who, you know, sing about, you know, there's this one band in called Diocletian in New Zealand, where they have a song called Restart Civilization. Basically it's, the whole song is just restart civilization, Romulus bidding iron beginning. We need to go back to Romulus and Remus, because that was, you know, that's where we need to go again to, in order to have society kind of aligned with the state of nature, in that sort of way. And so they have like, and this band uses Romulus and Remus imagery to sort of convey that idea that, you know, the Roman values is what we need to return to, you know, the values that made Rome and its people, you know, able to dominate the world.
Yeah, great values.
Yeah, you can see how that's problematic, and you know, and that gets into, you know, the politics of, you know, a lot of bands kind of singing about, you know, Virgil's Aeneid or the Spartans, and, you know, other, you know, classical topics, is especially bands in like Italy and Greece, but elsewhere too, in the bands like Australia and the British, you know, colonization places, you know, where these are cool things to sing about. Certainly, I mean, you know, just because you're doing this podcast doesn't mean you are invalidating a lot of, you know, the awful things that happen in these myths. But, you know, some people who sing about, you know, these topics, you know, are using them for, you know, nationalistic purposes. You know, this is my heritage, this is my tradition, you know, that I'm singing about. And, you know, and again, that's fine. But, you know, sometimes that is a slippery slope into, you know, this is my tradition and it's the superior tradition, and I'm trying to preserve, you know, my culture, and which I see is under threat. So there's some trickiness to this that is, you know, it has to be addressed with a lot of tact and nuance, which is what I've kind of encountered lately.
Yeah. So, well, that leads me right into it. It seems, at least based on like following you on Twitter for some time now, that there's definitely a level of like pretty obviously white supremacist bands in that world, and trying to kind of suss out which ones enjoy this heritage and sing about, I don't know if I want to use the word heritage, but enjoy this, like the world of the classical world in general, and those that are using it in that kind of nationalist, I mean, white supremacist kind of way. Right. Like, and I think that's classics pretty broadly. Mm-hmm. It's not specific to metal at all. It is specific to kind of classical usage almost on the internet. Internet's mm-hmm. obviously the best way to kind of find it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a common thing in general that classics have been used by white supremacists to perpetuate this like nonsensical ideal of like an ideal Western civilization, that they, you know, started the Western civilization as if they did not have any interactions with every single person to the south and the east of them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so yeah, like how big of an issue kind of is that in metal? Or it seems like you've encountered it a lot, is kind of all I have to say.
So, you know, again, this is the case with extremists in any group where it is, you know, a small minority of bands, but they're a vocal minority and they get a lot of attention. And Keith Conharris kind of theorized this, that, you know, one reason that they are so charismatic is they have what's called transgressive cultural capital. Okay, people are drawn to metal music because it's transgressive. It's a way of kind of channeling one's disenchantment with, you know, reality or just society or in some aspect of it, which is what it's been like since the beginning, when Black Sabbath, you know, wrote War Pigs, you know, and Electric Funeral and songs like that, responding to the Cold War. And then people are drawn to also to just artists who are, you know, transgressive, you know, and they see the transgression, whether it's their extreme politics, whether it's, you know, people, artists in Norway burning down churches, you know, they do all these things that we would say think are terrible, but because they are connected with music that is, you know, that speaks to them, suddenly they are kind of seen, it's seen as, you know, almost a forbidden fruit to listen to this stuff. And that's why a lot of these bands are more tolerated by a lot of metalheads, is that, you know, they're not necessarily accepting the politics of, you know, some artist like Varg Vikernes, who was big in the Norwegian black metal movement. And
is he the one, like the one of the sort of original?
Yes. Yeah. So he was one of the original kind of second wave of black metal in Norway, and he burned mm-hmm. down churches, and he murdered one of his bandmates. Or
I was going to say, I've heard this story.
Another person in the scene. And yeah, this has been well documented, but he's mm-hmm. still, he was in prison for, you know, over a decade, and then got out because the Norwegian prison system, you know, has
rehabilitate.
They rehabilitate, and, you know, they don't imprison you for that long. And now he's living in France, and he's still got, you know, a YouTube channel, and, you know, he's still writing books that kind of espouse this sort of hateful ideology. But, you know, of course, to him, he's, you know, saying, oh, I'm just preserving European heritage here and my culture. And he does touch on some, you know, classical mythology, you know, but though he's mostly into Norse stuff. So, for instance, you know, one of his ambient albums that he has released, you know, about 10 years ago, is it has a it uses as its cover art a painting by a Spanish artist, I think Ulpiano Checo, and it's El Rapto de Proserpina, and it's a painting of Hades abducting Persephone on his chariot. And I actually emailed him, tried to reach out to him to ask like what he's using that artwork for. He hasn't gotten back to me, and this is a common thing where, you know, I'm not trying to give a platform to these bands, but I'm trying at least to see what they have to say about what they're doing with this stuff, just to see, like, what are they really thinking here?
Yeah, like, what's the intention?
Often they don't reply.
kind of might answer the question a little bit.
Okay, so that was a bit of a digression there. But
yeah, that's my fault. It's because I've heard his story on My Favorite Murder, which is the podcast I listen to obsessively all the time, and they covered the death metal murders. And I was like, oh, I know that name. So.
Yeah. But, you know, the point here that I think I was making, if I can remember it, is, you know, the reason that this sort of stuff persists and is, you know, tolerated is, you know, because of a lot of people who listen to metal music sort of who metal heads, you know, throughout the world, you know, at least traditionally, you know, have been, you know, working class white men. And so, you know, because the politics of that are espoused by this music, you know, they might reject it, but they are threatened by it. And so mm-hmm. they're just like, oh, just enjoy the music, separate the art from the artist, you know, so much for the tolerant left, right? You know, freedom of expression and all that. And like, on the other hand, you know, you are giving platform, you know, to these bands. And, you know, and my concern here is that, you know, this is how a lot of people who listen to these bands might be introduced to the classical world through the interpretations of bands that, you know, sing about the Roman Empire in a certain way or about Zeus and all of that in a certain way. And just a caveat here, I'm not in favor of like censoring these bands, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't believe in political censorship, but I, you know, I do believe in informing people, you know, that not to platform these bands if you can help it, but ultimately it's their choice whether to, you know, to keep supporting these artists. So
yeah. Well, I think it's really interesting too, and the thing that often comes from that type of music, and I say this kind of from my own desire to be different and to go like against the grain when I was a teenager, because I like went to punk, but the idea is the same, right? Like I went to a pretty well-off high school where I did not even live in the area to go there, let alone like was the level of all the people that I went to high school with. And so in my like need to rebel, I went punk, where I just like listened to angry music that everyone thought was screaming in their ears, and I, you know, dyed my hair pink and black and wore chains everywhere, safety pins on everything I owned. And I think I look back on it with some really entertaining memories at times. I was very creative in my ridiculous form. Not to say that there's anything wrong with overall looking like that, but I went hard. I went ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, I think that the thing is teenagers are so drawn to that often because they feel so disaffected that it is probably important to point out some of these things when like a teenager could be coming to the classical world, but specifically in that kind of way, and then automatically be introduced to this idea, this like dangerous idea of the so-called Western civilization of it all. This idea that Greece and Rome was white and that they, you know, gave us everything we have, and that there was absolutely no one else of influence, and all those different things that are factually untrue but are so broadly amplified on the internet.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that, you know, to keep in mind here is, you know, a lot of classical reception, whether it's, you know, problematic or not, in metal, is, you know, it's taking a lot of cues from popular culture. You know, we already discussed, you know, they're taking on the Harryhausen Medusa, for instance. So, you know, a lot of metal that, you know, treats ancient history and mythology is inspired almost sometimes directly by Hollywood, video games, et cetera. So for instance, you know, one of the first concept albums based on the Odyssey, which came out, I think, in 1999 by a German band, I think, called Tarot's Mist. There are whole lines from the Amon de Santé Odyssey, you know, from 1997 that are in it. And that's not a problematic reception, but it's just an example that, you know, there's, you know, they're not necessarily looking at the primary sources, and a lot of this is filtered through popular culture. And that's certainly the case when, you know, 300 came out in 2006. Mm-hmm. Suddenly there were a ton of metal songs that were on the Battle of Thermopylae that came out, you know, in Greece and the United States and all over the place. But as a counterpoint to this, it's also good to keep in mind is, you know, there is, as in the field of classics, there's a reckoning in the global metal scene where, you know, people are confronting kind of the legacy of racism, sexism, and other kind of consequences of sort of this patriarchal, you know, white kind of foundations of heavy metal, which are not inherently, you know, white supremacist, but often is, you know, can go in those directions, just as with classics, right? And so today, you know, the metal scene is very global and diverse. People of every color, creed, and class, you know, listen to and play and write about metal, and, you know, all over the place. And so I think, you know, there's being a shift in not only how metal is sort of managing itself in terms of calling out some of these problematic artists, but it also affects classical reception as well. You know, if you look at like the myth of Medusa, for instance, if we want to come back to that, but also, you know, Medea and others, you know, we see that more nuanced or different perspectives on the myths like that are being are coming into play with some songs. So for instance, there's a French-Canadian band called Spectral Wound that a couple of years ago released a song called The Slaughter of Medusa. And if you read that song, it's, you know, it's the real monsters in this myth are Perseus and Athena. Hey, they're the one, you know, Perseus is, you know, he is killing her by deception. He's not very heroic. And then, you know, Athena is, you know, really the monster here for inflicting this suffering, this double suffering upon her, you know, being transformed and then being killed. And also, you know, the fact that metal is, you know, demographically diversifying means that more women and, you know, and people of color are getting into the scene being musicians. And so we see, you know, in the past couple decades, more bands with, say, women musicians writing songs about Medea or Cassandra or Medusa and others, written in the first person from those women's point of view and presenting kind of their case in more nuanced ways. And so I find that really refreshing.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I'm thrilled to hear that there's a version of Medusa like that, especially from a Canadian. Technically, I'm French-Canadian, so I'll hold on to that even though I don't really speak French. But that's very exciting. But so I'm curious, you sent me a version or a song about Medusa to listen to, and I found that one quite interesting because it was like a little bit sympathetic. I would say it was like probably overall sympathetic. I don't remember what the band was called, except that they used a pi symbol as an N.
Even one.
Right, yes. I was like, Eva, is it Eva Poir? And then once I closed it and looked at the YouTube, I was like, no, it's not. Okay. I'm learning, very slowly learning ancient Greek, so I'm finding myself making sure I pronounce out every time I see a Greek character. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but I was curious your thoughts on that, like why it was the one that you sent me to listen to. Kind of, yeah, tell me about that song.
Well, that's definitely a more recent song in sort of this evolution of kind of Medusa's reception in metal. And I also like that song from a, you know, a musicals perspective. It's a
I liked it.
It's a symphonic metal song. You know, it's, you know, I like the chorus a lot, so it's often stuck in my head. But, you know, we already discussed, you know, some of the earlier songs by like Athrax and other bands where, you know, Medusa is the other. She's exoticized, you know, sexualized. She is the, you know, the some sort of magical threat to, you know, masculine control. You know, she's terrorizing the world and therefore needs, you know, order and civilization, you know, need to be brought in by the male hero and take care of her, which, you know, is reading a lot more into the myth than was there, as we know. But these later versions, such as by Evenmore, finally we have songs where Medusa is given her own voice. We're seeing from her point of view, and she has more agency. So because there are some songs sort of more recent where, you know, she's viewed with more sympathy, they bring in kind of the backstory with you know, her assault by Poseidon, and, you know, Athena's transformation. But nevertheless, she is still a monster that needs to be dealt with. But in this song, for instance, what's interesting about the song is I kind of see the song as sort of a, it's written like Ovid's Heroides. In a way where, you know, it's Medusa kind of writing a letter to Poseidon, being like, you know, ever since our, you know, that night we were together, you know, my life has been changed forever. You know, I'm hideous. You know, nobody loves me anymore. And I feel like I've lost something. You know, so there's sort of a, you know, there's sort of a allegorical reading perhaps going on there too. But what's interesting about the song is she doesn't specifically kind of discuss the nature of her encounter with Poseidon. You know, she seems conflicted about what exactly happened, which I think is, I imagine, you know, I can't know, but I imagine this is sort of something that goes through, you know, perhaps people's minds after, you know, some sort of encounter like that. That they're working through and processing kind of the trauma and everything. So I found that a very interesting take, where it's neither, you know, condemning Medusa as a monster, but also giving her some agency and her own sort of complexity as a thinking human being, rather than just simply, you know, pitying her as a passive victim.
Yeah. It hit me. It's very sad. Like, it's a very sad take on her, but it is very aimed at Poseidon in, yeah, in an interesting way. Which I think too is like, is almost, you know, even more mythologically accurate, because as you well know, the phrasing on her encounter with Poseidon, when we're talking about like very early sources, is pretty up in the air. And which I find quite interesting. So yeah, it's nice to have a take like that where, you know, it's not using the Ovid version, but as, you know, every angry man on Twitter likes to point out, Ovid changed it and Ovid did all these things and Ovid this and Ovid that. And so, yeah, to have it be like a little bit more specific to the original, I'm not saying original myth, take back that word original, but to the early sources.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it's just an interesting thing. And one of the things you were saying earlier just brought me back to the most recent Medusa explosion that I think you also experienced too that time on Twitter like last month, because somebody told me that her death was necessary, like she deserved to die because one, she'd been tormenting the lands, nonsense, and that also that it like alleviated some kind of like weight on the world, that like killing her actually like solved a major world problem, which is something I've heard before and I hate it so much I have to talk about it right now, because it's like this idea that a woman's death is somehow beneficial to like an entire planet. It's so dark, and it's just this way of people making themselves feel better about Medusa, or this way of like, I always say people, I mean men, but it's like this way of having men like have this acceptance that like, no, it's fine that she was killed. She needed to be killed. Like it, you know, it did this whole thing. There's a podcast that last time I talked about Medusa, I had recommended to me and I listened to it, and I won't name it because I'm about to say how crazy it was, but it was this whole like epic theory of all these like psychological and mythological, but also like, I don't even know the word I want, but basically this idea that like Medusa represented this huge, huge darkness in the world, and that her death was necessary. But they used all these like absolutely crazy theories and didn't list sources at all, or like as if that there was a sort of metaphysical is the word I want, like as if there was this like metaphysical reason why Medusa had to be killed in this way, where I'm like, what do you think Greek mythology, like they were just understanding the things around them, like there's not, I mean there's definitely more to it than that, and there's more to it than I think that, you know, the stories say, but at the same time, like the story of Medusa, especially in terms of how little actually is written on it in ancient sources, like is not that. It is not some metaphysical, like, if anything, like I could argue that the Iliad, like the Trojan War, is some kind of like deeper thing from the ancient world. But anyway, could go on forever. But that one really got to me because it's just so dark. And like, I know it's the people would tell you explicitly it's not misogynistic, but it inherently is misogynistic to suggest this, because like nothing in the ancient sources suggested whatsoever.
Yeah, definitely. Like, yeah, she was, this wasn't like, you know, the labors of Heracles or Theseus, where these were, you know, menaces to the mainland of Greece that, you know, were killing people and stuff. She was on the edge of the world. You know, she was keeping to herself. He had to go. And the other thing, and this is, I think it was amidst all this, you know, this shitstorm on Twitter, is somebody came in being like, well, Perseus had to kill her because he was trying to save his mother Danae. And I was like, Perseus killed Medusa because he needed a wedding gift for Polydectes, whom he thought Polydectes was going to be married to some other woman, and didn't had no idea that Polydectes was just trying to get rid of him so that he could get at Danae. So yes, he inadvertently, you know, saved his mother by, you know, eventually coming back and turning Polydectes to stone. But like, he had no idea that he was doing this for any other reason than basically getting a hunting trophy to give as a wedding gift because he didn't have any horses.
Well, and that's the thing about her too. Like in modern representation of her, it's like she's in this cave full of statues suggesting that she's killed all these people. She's turned them all to stone. And I think I haven't reread Ovid super recently. So I think maybe he suggests that. But no other sources that I have ever found, and I have read a lot on Medusa in terms of ancient sources, suggest that she had actually turned anyone to stone. Like, there's no evidence that she did. Like, sure, she had the ability, but we don't actually have, like, examples of, like, people she harmed in that way. The only obvious examples are once her head is off and then Perseus is using it, which is definitely not her fault. But this idea, that she deserved it at all, because like you said, it is explicit in the ancient sources that she lived at the end of the world. She literally lived as far away from humanity as physically possible. Like, it was about to drop off into the edge of Oceanus. Like, she was not causing any trouble anywhere. It's just so interesting.
Yeah. And you know, the only thing there is, you know, there's, you know, it kind of fits in with, you know, other Greek myth where, you know, the Argonauts or the Greek expedition to Troy, you know, and others, where they're trying to spread human civilization to the far corners of the world in order to conquer it and to subdue it, you know, subdue the barbarians. And then, you know, Herodotus picks up on this too, with all of his, you know, nonsense about what is, you know, here be dragons and golden hands and stuff, right? So
I haven't read a ton of Herodotus, but what I've read are like little phrase, like little passages and stuff I see every now and again. I'm like, I think you didn't totally know what was going on there. Well, yeah, I mean, Medusa obviously is the thing I go back to talking about her as much as possible, especially with how many shitstorms I've gotten into on Twitter, because I just feel like the more men try to tell me that she deserved to be killed, the more I have to talk about how that's crazy.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the Ferryman of Souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you Death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tail.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian Mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the other songs you sent me was about Cassandra, and I want to talk about that one because it was very interesting. So I don't know if you want to name it, because I'm also going to forget who it was by.
Yeah, so this is Cassandra by Theater of Tragedy. They're a Norwegian band, you know, they'd be typically called gothic metal. And so, you know, and the song is, it's a duet between, you know, a male and a man and a woman vocalist, which is, you know, pretty not uncommon in that genre. Yeah, and in fact, this is a song that there's actually scholarship written on it. I guess I should plug this, actually, if I want to do a little ad, even though I have nothing to do with it. So a couple years ago was published the first edited volume of scholarship on classical reception in heavy metal music, and by KFB Fletcher, who's at LSU, and Osman Umerhan at the University of Mexico. I see them as sort of the godfathers of heavy metal classics studies I sort of came to a little later. And so there's actually a chapter in that volume called Cassandra's Plight, Gender, Genre, and Historical Concepts of Femininity in Gothic and Power Metal. And it basically does close readings of, and it's by Linnea Osheda and Anna Foka, who I believe are scholars in Sweden. And they look at first Blind Guardian, which is a power metal band from Germany that, you know, they have a song called, and then there was Silence, which, you know, talks about Cassandra kind of foreseeing her death in the Agamemnon and the fall of Troy and everything. And then also the song Cassandra by Theater of Tragedy, and which is more about her relationship with Apollo.
Yeah, it was very interesting because it's about her relationship with Apollo. Also, the language they use is like very, this is me not being a scholar whatsoever. I'm going to call it old-timey because I can't think of a better phrase. But it's quite interesting, the language they use. And then, but it seems to be like the point is kind of questioning her relationship with Apollo and what it actually was, and therefore like kind of what she actually was.
Yeah, definitely. And that, yes, that band's language is rather inscrutable, and so I don't really have, you know, too much to add on this.
Cool, I'm glad I felt that way.
But you know, it does, but again, it's like you know, the song Tears of Medusa by Evenoir, where, you know, we're bringing more complexity to this because we are getting, you know, kind of Cassandra or Medusa's perspective, where, you know, it's not, you know, it's more complex than that. And especially where, you know, we can see how these sort of myths kind of resonate with, you know, similar experiences, you know, that we have today with, you know, our romantic partners or whatever, and what happens there.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I actually had to Google other uses of the word fond, because the chorus is basically like prophetess or fond, and I was like, I am definitely missing something in that word. So I, yeah, they're using it to mean like foolish, it seems, which is quite interesting. But yeah, I don't know. It was an interesting one to listen to, and also one to try to understand the English. So I'm glad to hear you kind of feel similarly on it.
Yeah,
because it makes it sort of difficult to totally understand what they're saying, which maybe is on purpose. Or I mean, they're also, you said Norwegian, so, well, Norwegians speak great English, so that's not a good
reason. I think that's sort of, they're using some sort of like Kunstsprache, like, you know, like stage Doric in Greek tragedy, right? You know, intentionally to kind of bring that sort of arcane old-timey feel. And you know, it reminds me of another band that does things like that called Wrathblade, and they're a Greek band, and they have a lot of songs about mythology also, and so a lot of their lyrics use some very interesting vocabulary, you know, you can check out. So for instance, this is not necessarily mythology, but it is, they have a song called Submersion, and it is about the destruction of the polis of Helike in the 4th century BCE by an earthquake and tsunami. And I forget who the source for this is, but basically the idea was that they had offended Poseidon somehow, and so he basically destroyed the city that way, because those are his things. And you know, it's one of my favorite songs in this, on this kind of topic. But it also demonstrates kind of some of these key themes, where the song is the basis for the album artwork of the album it's on, which is called God of the Deep Unleashed, where it's basically, there's a tidal wave and about to overwhelm this, you know, this city with all these Greek temples and stuff, and everything's on fire, and there's earthquake. It's chaos. Metal loves chaos. It's all about chaos, right? you know, and then standing out over this tidal wave is this completely jacked Poseidon, who looks like, you know, and then you listen to the song, and it's like, you know, the chorus is like, behold Poseidon. And it's like, the song is so, it's so good that you forget that Poseidon is a fucking piece of shit. And you just, you know, and that's sort of kind of the seduction that a lot of heavy metal does with presenting these sort of kind of masculine kind of role models of, you know, you want to be like these warriors, you want to be self-sufficient, you want to be in control, you want to, you know, you want to, like, you know how to use a sword, you know, because a sword
be a trident,
because a sword, you know, because a sword is, you know, a much more manly weapon than a bow and arrow or a gun, because you have to look your enemy in the face, and, you know, all of that. And, you know, heavy metal's all about that. So that was a bit of digression. I just wanted to talk about that song and that album artwork, because, like, it's one of my go-tos where somebody's like, give me a song you like that is on this, you know, classical reception. And they're just such a good band. They have other great songs too. So I wanted to give a shout out to them.
Well, it sounds great. I mean, I think that's really fascinating, because it's not like a, you know, it's not like a go-to story from the classical world. Like, I think that's much more like deep cut kind of.
Yeah. And that's what I love about the fact that classical reception is so widespread in metal, that, you know, a lot of bands are not just going for the go-to topics, like, you know, like those you can imagine that are popular. There are a lot of bands that are, you know, they're looking deep into pseudo Apollodorus and Ovid and others, for, you know, myths that are, or stories that are, you know, less talked about. So for instance, actually the same vocalist for Wrathblade also has a band, he's also the vocalist for a band from California called Serpent Rider, and they have a song called Pour Forth Cerquitius, and it's a song about that episode from the Argonautica where Polydeuces has a boxing match with Amycus, you know, the king who basically forces everybody to box with him, and he usually ends up killing them. And then Polydeuces, you know, finally shows up, and he, you know, smashes his face and he drops dead. And so it's a wonderful little song about that episode that, you know, most people kind of forget about, you know, when they think about the story of Jason the Argonauts. If you go back to, you'll go to metalarchives.com, that's metal-archives, you can go search for basically any mythological figure, and chances are there may be a song that at least, you know, mentions them in passing, at least, to kind of show that inspiration.
I can't believe that exists. That's amazing to have like a full archive like that. Like, that sounds so unrealistic to me. That's really exciting that that's a thing.
Yeah, it really helps. It's sort of the digital humanities kind of aspect to my work, where you have this database where I can actually like make charts and quantify, how classical reception works in metal, because there's just so much data out there that I can discuss, trends that, this topic was more popular in this year, in this part of the world, in this genre, so many different triangulations there. But yeah, I encourage you guys to kind of run through that database, because it's very rich diversity of stories by bands all over the world. It's not just, the bands that are traditional, kind of epicenters of metal, like, Europe and the United States, but, bands from, all the continents, except Antarctica, probably,
seems fair.
have stuff. And so, and I think that's just going to continue as metal continues to diversify and globalize, because, classics and Greek mythology and all of that belongs to everybody. And
sure does. I mean, I take it, and I'm just very Canadian.
Yeah, and there's certainly plenty of Canadian bands that that participate too. So, like the ones that I mentioned.
Yeah, that's very cool. I think that my listeners would want me to ask, and also now I'm just curious, how represented are Hades and Persephone in metal?
Persephone, she's mentioned, but I already mentioned, Burzum, Varg Vikernes's band, uses that right. Opiano Cecco painting. Persephone is mentioned, but, I haven't really looked too much into, how much the Homeric hymn to Demeter is used in metal. Can't think of anything that kind of pops out. But she is mentioned. So, for instance, I think the band Therion has a song on Persephone that you can look up. But certainly Hades definitely is. Actually, Hades is the only kind of mythological figure that has more hits than Medusa if you type in the Metal Archives. But the reason for that, of course, is that Hades is also a place.
Right.
And it's often used interchangeably with the Christian hell, underworld. So like the song, like the first song by Bathory on their first album is called Hades, and it's probably, and it has really nothing to do with Greek mythology, but that's just, that's what the Bible calls hell, Hades.
Yeah, I hadn't thought
about
that.
It even calls it Tartarus at times. So it's really more, and then that also is another interesting aspect of classical reception in metal, is how it seamlessly kind of melds with kind of Christian mythology, Dante's Inferno and all of that, the river, because Dante's Inferno is also basically Virgil's hell with extra steps, right? The rivers,
more
all
intricate
punishments and all of that, and so Hades is seen as sort of this kind of satanic figure, like in the Disney movie, it's not a hard step to take. So he's there. Though in terms of kind of how, this is a worthy transition here, in terms of how, like, since a lot of metal is, especially more extreme genres, are attracted to this idea of Satan and hell as sort of these kind of symbols of transgression and a rejection of, kind of modernity and, organized religion, etc., as well as sort of the celebration of, liberating kind of one's animal instincts and whatnot, their carnal desires, that have been so suppressed by, say, Christian or other forms of morality. So the figure that is one of the most popular figures in heavy metal's classical reception is Prometheus.
Okay.
And again, there's a long tradition of this. You know, if you look at Goethe and Shelley, Percy Shelley specifically, you know, kind of look at Prometheus as this kind of very much like Satan in Paradise Lost, where he represents sort of the liberation of humanity from the chains of subservience to, you know, a deity, whether it be Zeus or the Christian God or otherwise. And he is sort of seen as the savior of humanity by bringing them forbidden knowledge. And then Mary Shelley plays with that too, you know, with, you know, Victor bringing the spark of life to create the monster. So a lot of bands are attracted to the Prometheus myth as this sort of symbol of, you know, the light of knowledge and wisdom, you know, being retrieved kind of illicitly from the control of religion in general. So Prometheus is sort of like this satanic figure. I think a good example is one of my favorite kind of Prometheus songs that you can listen to is by the Swedish symphonic metal band Therion. Okay. And they have a song called Prometheus entfesselt, which is actually in German. So, but you can easily put the lyrics into Google Translate. And it's about, you know, again, it means Prometheus bound. And it plays with a lot of that, you know, defy the law of Zeus is one of the lyrics there. It really speaks to metal's sort of core ethos as, you know, celebrating transgression for its own sake.
Interesting. It's funny. I mean, I should not be remotely surprised that Persephone's not in it a lot. But I'm just so interested in that, mostly because like they are not my favorite at all. I have my own feelings about them, but it seems to me that lately that's like the only mythological character that gets talked about beyond like deep mythology world. Mm-hmm. And I'm just so interested in why it is that they have become this like epic force. I mean, I think it's all based in like romanticism. Mm-hmm. So probably not like a metal thing that it would take on or that would, you know, catch on pretty easily. But it's just an interesting way that the certain characters that kind of pop up as the most talked about.
Yeah. And I'm glad you bring that up because we see all sort of the Hades and Persephone fanfic, you know, and artwork and stuff in comics. But you know, romance, it's turned into kind of this romance, and that's not really a topic that heavy metal tends to dwell on just because, you know, besides like hair metal, glam metal, pop metal from the 80s, where it was all about celebrating, you know, sexuality and liberation and all of that. You know, metal doesn't really dwell on that because, again, this sort of traditionally metal is this sort of Black Sabbath, for instance, they rejected singing about love that they did that rock bands did in the 60s, and instead they were dwelling on, you know, darker themes of war and, you know, drug use and kind of disillusionment that, you know, the 1970s was. And so metal sort of sees romance as sort of in the same way that they kind of see, they have, again, the figure of the femme fatale where, you know, surrendering to that kind of softer side of oneself is, you know, relinquishing control in some way. Mm-hmm. So it tends not to dwell on that too much, but, so Persephone and Hades is not really seen in that way. Hecate is somewhat popular though.
Oh, that's good.
Generally because, metal is often fascinated with sorcerers and witches in general. Mm-hmm. And again, back to the femme fatale stuff with that. And so Hecate is often invoked as sort of this, you know, is this force of darkness in the underworld, and, you know, kind of satanic rituals and all of that fun stuff that has been in metal, you know, since the beginning. So speaking of Hecate and a certain priestess of Hecate, I suppose we're the next step is to talk about Medea.
Yes. but is she like a topic used often? Like, and is it because of witchcraft? Is it because of the murder? Like, yeah, what's the deal there?
I mean, Medea is, you know, not the most popular figure in metal like Medusa is, but you know, there's still a fair amount there, you know, on her, and there's quite a range, and that's you know, why it's so fascinating is that just as, you know, she is variously interpreted, you know, according to audience. So for instance, you know, that it's, there's that old, you know, debate, you know, was Euripides a proto-feminist, quote unquote, or a misogynist in presenting the Medea and others, you know, mm-hmm. Aristophanes would certainly suggest that, you know, he was seen as a misogynist, you know, with all the plays where it's like, all the women are like, no, we need to get rid of Euripides. He's making women look bad. But of course, you know, various audiences have seen otherwise. And I think metal's reception of Medea is similar, where we have some bands that, you know, condemn her, some that are sympathetic, and then some that are conflicted. So for instance, you know, one of my, one of the songs I talk about in the blog post is the song Medea by the Greek black metal band Kaweer. Okay. And Kaweer are a good band to bring up in general, because they're a black metal band from the early 90s that are still going strong, and they're from Greece, and they are an example of a metal band that is not only interested in Greek mythology, but they are actually Hellenic neo-pagans. They're part of the growing movement in Greece and elsewhere, where, you know, they're actually worshiping the gods that they sing about. And then mm-hmm. in the volume by Umerhan and Fletcher I mentioned, there's also a chapter about how Kaweer use the ancient hymn format in presenting various songs to Dionysus and Zeus and other figures in their music. But they also have a song about Medea, that song, you know, represents Medea as very much a kind of a metaphysical evil figure. She's very satanic. She's, you know, a witch and a sorceress and murderess, and because of that, she is this goes back to the transgressive capital, right? She's therefore an attractive figure to sing about in metal because she symbolizes that transgression. Mm-hmm. So another popular person in metal that she is similar to with that song is Elizabeth Bathory. Okay, since the 80s, bands like Bathory and Venom and many subsequent kind of latched onto Elizabeth Bathory as this sort of, you know, ultimate symbol of transgression, murder, sexuality, the femme fatale, you know, and all of that. And so Kaweer kind of paint Medea like this in a way. I encourage you to look at that song. It's in modern Greek. You know, again, run it through translator. But what's funny with that song, though, is, you know, it uses some kind of more archaic, older meanings, certain words. So, for instance, it refers to Medea in modern Greek as like a pharmakis or pharmakeia or something like that. You know, words where if you look at it, it's like, oh, that's the word for witch or magic or whatever. Type it into Google Translate and then you get lines like evil Medea, the pharmacist, is like... She sorceress practicing health insurance policies. it's like, well, yeah, health insurance, private health insurance is metaphysically evil. unlike it's something in, you know, a country like the US where we have to deal with that, unlike civilized countries. Anyway, tangent there. So there's that end of the spectrum. And then there's other songs, often by bands that are, you know, have women vocalists or women musicians, where mm-hmm. it's Medea's own perspective. And she is, you know, it's very much like the Euripides play, because throughout the Euripides play, you know, she is kind of vocalizing her inner conflict. Like, she's like, I definitely got to get revenge. I definitely have to kill my children to do it. But I don't wanna, and then finally she does it. And so these songs kind of represent a lot of those inner monologues quite well. You know, bands like Ex Libris have I believe they're from the Netherlands, I think they're a symphonic metal band, which have an entire album concept album on Madea, you know, where she is kind of working through, you know, not just, you know, the decision of how to take revenge, but also her relationship with Jason, you know, where she's, you know, she's still in love with him, still under Aphrodite's or Cupid's spell. But on the other hand, you know, she was so, you know, wronged by him, you know, for obvious reasons. So that's definitely worth checking out. And in fact, there's one song where it's actually, there's a dialogue between her and a male vocalist who plays Jason, and they're kind of, you know, they're having that back and forth that you get in the Euripides play. So it's, you know, and that's why I encourage you guys to listen to these songs, because it's not just the lyrics, but also see how the music is kind of conveying these tensions and emotions and whatnot. And that's what I really, one reason I really think that metal is such a great medium to retell classical myth is, you know, metal is, you know, it channels, you know, through music, a lot of these kind of violent emotions and these kind of somber moods that you may not get necessarily in other forms of music, though certainly other forms of music can certainly convey that, such as Joe Goodkin's, you know, his folk acoustic bits on the Odyssey and the Iliad are, you know, really bring tears to your eyes as well. So, you know, metal is, you know, not unique in being able to do that.
But I realize what we didn't say, and so I will put it up front as well. So you are going to give me a Spotify playlist that people can listen to as well, right? So we can... people can definitely like Google the songs that you've talked about, but we'll also have, there will be a Spotify playlist in the episode description. So you can just link straight to it from listening to this episode and then get the real, get kind of everything that you've talked about in one place, which I think will be perfect.
Yes, indeed. And and I encourage you also to, you know, to look at the artwork for some of the artists I've mentioned as well, because, you know, it's, you know, metal is not just about sound or even, you know, words, but it's a visual thing. It's meant to be performed live, just like Homeric poetry. And so it's a multimedia experience. So there's plenty of, you know, there's material culture and stuff to consume here as well.
Yeah, well, and I mean, even just the few album artwork pieces that I've Googled since talking to you, or while we were talking, even, because I wanted to get the sense while you're talking about it, but they're also epic, like, I think is the best word to describe it. And, you know, some are so over the top, like you were talking about that one of Medusa and Perseus, and Medusa is so like hypersexualized in that one, and green and so like monstrous, while also just being incredibly sexualized. It's an interesting sort of juxtaposition and understanding of her in that way.
I think one thing we didn't touch upon much was the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Right.
And so like the Odyssey,
could be obvious. Yeah.
You know, the Odyssey is one of the most popular, you know, stories, you know, from Greek mythology that's in metal, and probably one of the most well-known pieces of Odyssey reception, in one of the most iconic kind of, when people think of, classical myth and heavy metal, is the song The Odyssey by Symphony X, a symphonic metal band.
Is that the one you sent me?
That's the one I sent you, yes.
Okay, yeah.
And,
it is 26 minutes, so I bounced around it a little bit so I could still talk about it. But yeah, it was quite interesting and quite descriptive, like just is the story in a song.
Yeah, and, you know, it's pretty exemplary of sort of how heavy metal sort of transforms the complicated man of Odysseus into a typical heavy metal hero, where, you know, we think of the Odyssey as, you know, he's a different kind of hero. You know, he uses his brains rather than his brawn. He's unlike Achilles, you know, he's wise and older and all that. Whereas heavy metal is celebrates, you know, the energy of youth and, you know, more physical, you know, masculinity. And then so the Odysseus in a lot of metal songs is actually more like an Achilles. He, you know, they focus on his ability to use brute force to get out of situations, to certainly in slaughtering the suitors at the end, but also like, you know, the Cyclops and everything. And also they show him as resisting the temptations of dangerous women, not giving in. So all the every time it mentions Cersei, it doesn't mention the fact that, they basically, had an affair for a year, and that, she took him to her bed after the, after swearing the oath and everything. It doesn't mention that.
And it was the easiest thing ever. It
doesn't mention that. She's just, a typical femme fatale witch who, tried to bring him under her spell, and, he resisted. Sometimes they don't even mention the Hermes bit there. And then basically his return to Ithaca is basically the restoration of justice and order. And he's, kind of more one-dimensional as a hero, but in that way, not universal, there's certainly some depth to him in certain instances, but that's generally the trend there. And mm-hmm. one of the most popular episodes from the Odyssey that is in metal, probably more than anything else, is the encounter with the sirens.
That kind of suits.
Yeah. Again, the sirens, another example of, the allure of, highly, sexualized of women that, threaten one's own control, self-control or otherwise. And so the siren songs are definitely there a lot. For instance, the album artwork to the album The Odyssey, on which that song is, by Symphony X, is the episode from the Sirens where Odysseus is tied to the mast. And if you look at Odysseus, he is, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Conan the Barbarian, long hair, beard, stacked. And then the sirens, instead of being, the bird women from the ancient artistic sources, they are basically naked women, highly, sexualized with demons' bat wings, that are kind of flying around the ship. And the ship is in a storm because, of course. So this sort of gives you an idea of how heavy metal is kind of revisioning these myths as sort of, the sirens are these sort of satanic, witch figures that, threaten, the heroes, distract the hero from their quest and all of that.
So funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I think that's so fascinating. I mean, the sirens in general, it's funny because it is such like a brief moment. So I like, but it suits. And I think that it would be something focused on a lot.
Yeah. And just one more thing on that. So, when you read the Odyssey, what are the sirens actually saying to Odysseus? They're saying, hey, we know stuff. We have knowledge of all these things, past, present, future, whatever. And if you come to us, you will also have this knowledge because, that's Odysseus. He wants to know things. Whereas the sirens in heavy metal, they're offering, their sexual allurements. Okay, they are attracted. Right. They're attracting him to carnal knowledge, if you will, rather than the things he was really after, supposedly. Right. So that's all consistent with what we've been talking about.
Yeah, that sort of masculinity part. Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely fascinating. I'm glad we got in Odysseus at the end. But thank you so much for doing this. This has been so fascinating.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to talk about all this. And I'm glad we were able to cover, a pretty wide range of examples and themes and certainly issues that are, relevant to, things beyond metal and classics. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I think that's important too. Yeah.
Why does this mm-hmm. matter?
Yeah, exactly, right? And I mean, the mythology is obviously the important thing, or is an important thing for me, but obviously, my show, I really want to try to kind of go beyond that and look at how it impacts the modern world, so mm-hmm. I think this was kind of a perfect way to do it all. But yeah, so where can people find you? What do you want to share with everyone?
Okay. Well, so you can follow me on Twitter at Metal Classicist. That's where I, do a lot of my public engagement. And you can also see my blog, heavymetalclassicist.homeblog. And also, I have a Facebook page called Heavy Metal and the Ancient World. So those are kind of the main places. And if you're interested in more of my scholarship, beyond this, I'm on academia.edu. Just search for Jeremy Swiss. You can see some of the other things I've written on other topics. Because, I do other things than heavy metal reception. I work on late antiquity and the reception of early Rome in the Roman Empire.
Mm. Awesome. That's so great. That's perfect. And I mean, highly recommend a Twitter follow for sure, because I have a lovely time following on Twitter. I kind of jumped in at one point, but the world of classics on Twitter is quite a fun place to be. I appreciate it.
Yeah, a lot of memes and shit posting, but and cats. So
yeah, a lot of cats. So, always so, a lot of cats.
So you know, that'll be what you're getting into if you follow me.
Yeah, but I think that's fun. It's like, it's academic. It's, you learn a lot, but it's also like everyone has fun. It's mm-hmm. great. Yeah. Well, thank you again. I so appreciate it.
Yeah. Anytime.
Ugh, nerds, thank you all so much for listening, as usual. I mean, I said it up front, so I won't repeat myself, but mostly just thank you. This is so much fun. I learned so much. You learned so much. We have a great time. Make sure you check out the Spotify playlist that we mentioned. Again, it is available in the episode's description. Even just like the album art on a lot of these things, these songs and albums are fascinating and really... really interesting. So I highly recommend you check it all out. There's so much classical reception everywhere, and it's really fascinating learning the intricacies and all the little places in which mythology and Greek history appears throughout the whole modern world. What a time. Thank you all so much. You're the best. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.